Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile and smart speaker. This is the James Gray Show with the Lords Taverners.
You're listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio, on DAB Digital, online or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
England taking on Norway in Le Havre tonight. And it's a massive game for English football, I think. You know, after what was a brilliant summer last year, that the Lionesses have really got a chance to convert that and take that momentum forward. And, you know, if you haven't watched much of the Women's World Cup, and you might be forgiven for doing so, because the group stages, there were times at which the group stages didn't impress. You know, that game, I think, is quite damaging, the USA thrashing of Thailand, and there was a lot said about the lack of quality in women's football that just wasn't fair. But actually, if you've only just turned onto it, and if you only started watching during the knockout stages, you will have been given an absolute rollercoaster ride and a lot of very high-quality football. You know, I will be the first to say that Cameroon were a disgrace, and the way they played football was disgraceful. Argentina were extremely defensive and disappointing to watch. I'm not just going to sit here and cheerlead women's football, because it doesn't need it anymore in some ways. Actually, it's a good enough game now that you can watch these matches and enjoy them for football spectacles that they are. And that's what I'd expect tonight. Because while England are favourites, you know, they're not 90% favourites. This is a tough game against Norway, and fate hasn't exactly conspired to help England in the knockout stages in this World Cup. For a start, they came up against Cameroon, who frankly had a dual purpose. They either decided that they were going to knock England out of the World Cup, or they were going to injure them so much that they might as well be out of the World Cup. It was a disgraceful display. They argued with the referee. They stopped playing at one point over a VAR decision that frankly didn't go their way, but was still correct. So it's very disappointing when you see performances like that. But overall, the quality has been good. And England have had to work hard to get through to the quarterfinals. Another thing that's probably going to work against them tonight is the weather. It's likely to be pretty hot, pretty muggy. We're expecting, even when it kicks off at 8 o'clock UK time, 9 o'clock local, even by then, it's expected to be something like 25, 26 degrees and a high level of humidity. Now, it's almost a cliche to say that English teams struggle in the heat, but they will. They just will. The Norwegians actually might be more acclimatised to it, not because they play in Norway, but because most of them play in Central Europe. There's obviously a couple of players who play in England as well, but you'll see a lot of them spend a lot of time playing in Europe. So, frankly, they might enjoy the heat a little bit more. There are excuses as well. You know, England have got in two injury doubts. Steph Houghton was hacked down in the Cameroon game. She's still recovering from that. She has trained, I believe, but nevertheless, still recovering. And Millie Bright, she's basically been locked in her room with a virus to try and avoid it spreading more. These injuries are a worry, but manager Phil Neville, he doesn't seem too perturbed.
You're going to pick up bugs along the way, and touch wood, we've been very lucky. Injuries and illnesses, we've had none, touch wood, apart from one or two. So it's par for the course. It happens in life. It's a virus. She more than likely is going to be fit, but at this moment in time, she's a doubt.
Yeah, I mean, they very much are in doubt, those two players, Steph Houghton and Millie Bright, the two centre-halves that England have been playing. So there's plenty of excuses there. You know, if England do lose to Norway tonight, it will not be as though they've fluffed a perfect opportunity. There are excuses, which I always think as a sports person is quite convenient, but I know for a fact that Neville will not allow them to use those as excuses. It's just not something I think he's disposed to doing. But there are plenty of, if you pardon the pun, bright sides to look on as well. For starters, their opponents are without their best player. You know, Ada Hegerberg is the Ballon d'Or winner, and she's not at the World Cup. She would be the best player at this World Cup, but she's boycotting it as a protest to the treatment of women's football. It's a very brave thing to do, and I've no doubt she has her reasons, but it does leave Norway without their best player. They're obviously not completely without talent, because no side relies entirely on one player. But nevertheless, this is a psychological blow as well as a footballing blow to this Norwegian team. Because when you've got a player like Ada Hegerberg, when you're in trouble, you can just say, oh no, we're 1-0 down, 15 minutes to go, give it to Ada, she'll do something, she'll make something happen. And they don't have that option now. Of course, there's the Millie Bright issue. You know, as Phil Neville mentioned there, she's been ill. This kind of thing does happen. But England are not without replacements. Actually, some people might say, might argue, that an injury to Bright benefits England. Because she is from the old school. You know, she's an old-fashioned great big centre-half. You know, she really is that sort of player, as Roberto Martinez would say. But her distribution is not perfect. You know, one of the things that Steph gives you at centre-half is someone who is a very strong defender, is very mobile, but also is able to pass the ball. If Bright is not available, they'll probably bring in Amy McManus. And if anything, that improves the side. Sure, she's not as big and strong as Millie Bright, but she has a better distribution. She plays with Steph Houghton at Manchester City, so there's no shortage of experience together there. And she does allow England to play better in possession, so it might just work. And on Steph Houghton, by the way, it looks like she's going to be fit. She trained yesterday. She's had a shin injury. That's the official problem. I mean, that's baffling in itself because it was a slide tackle. And this is such a poor tackle that her studs went over the ankle and actually hit the side of her shin. And it was a contact, not a bone bruise almost, that she actually suffered. But she does look like she's recovering from that. She got warm in the warm-up yesterday in the training session. It looked extremely hot. But Steph's such an important part of this team. Obviously knows Abby McManus quite well, probably play alongside her. She's a leader. She's very vocal. She's a really important part of the organisation. And I think it's crucial that we see her involved tonight. And also, it's crucial that she kind of takes on that leadership role. And I don't think Steph would shy away from the challenge. And I think Phil Neville's been quite clear about this. He doesn't think this is a team who gets scared of the challenge. I kind of agree with him. Someone like Steph Houghton, as captain, is able to stand up as the skipper and allow the team to play around her. You know, she's played everywhere. Remember that she was a striker. When she started at Sunderland as a kid, she was a prolific striker. And she's moved her way slowly back and back, which is sort of tends to be what happens. I actually think Steph could still play up front for England. She's that talented. I still think she could do a job up front for England. But she's going to be doing a job, we hope, tonight at centre-half. England will need her because I don't think they've faced as good a side as Norway. And this will probably be their biggest challenge. Because Japan were decent and obviously gave them a bit of a scare. But I think Norway are a better side. I think they're a bit more organised. I think they're a bit better in defence. Probably the best defence England have played, actually. With the ball, I don't think they're that different from Japan. But I do think that Norway will give them the toughest defensive test. I also want to talk about another issue that's come up during this World Cup, which is that of VAR, and specifically what happens with penalties and the video assistant referee, because there's a little scrap developing between Mike Riley and Pierluigi Collina. Now, look, I think there are a lot of pay-per-view fights that really shouldn't be pay-per-view fights these days. Mike Riley versus Pierluigi Collina, that's a fight I would pay to see. Wouldn't you? I think we all would, to be fair. I do imagine, though, that Collina would eat him alive. I think he's probably a pretty hard man when it comes to those fights. But anyway, the reason that they're on a sort of collision course is that it seems the Premier League are not going to adopt some of the new laws that have been written into football. And most specifically, it's this one over penalties. Now, the new laws suggest that the goalkeeper must have one foot on the line as a penalty is being taken. Now, that's fine, but we have seen that particular rule enforced by the video assistant referee, which to me feels like pedantry of the highest level. And we saw it at the end of the Scotland-Argentina game. Scotland goalkeeper made a brilliant save. A brilliant save to what looked like keep Scotland in the tournament. And then it went to the video assistant referee and she was millimetres away from being legal. Now, I think that rule has been one of the most flaunted. You know, goalkeepers are pretty used to just taking a step forward off their line. And I don't really think anyone's that bothered about it. I don't think people mind goalkeepers taking a step forward off the line to try and gain a bit of an advantage. Because frankly, But a penalty kick is already a massive advantage to the striker. So I don't see why you should need to stop the goalkeeper taking a step off the line. Will the Premier League sort of say no to these laws? I think they might. It's obviously the PGMOL, that's what Mike Riley is in charge of, and that's why he is at the centre of this. I think the Premier League and the PGMOL, for that matter, have often thought and long thought themselves above the laws of the game, above other footballing authorities. So I wouldn't be that surprised to see the Premier League basically go, you know what, we don't fancy that rule. We're not going to tell our VARs to enforce that rule. You do what you want, but we've got our own thing going on. I think they will just do that, and they'll just say, you know what, we are our own league, and we'll do what we want.
Love Sport.
Jamie Jackson's the Manchester football correspondent for The Guardian, I should say. Jamie, also a standout day if you're a Manchester United fan, because it looks like they're going to announce a £50 million signing. Aaron Wan-Bissaka, do we think we will get news on that today, Jamie?
Possibly. They may. The medical going on today, I understand. So they will be preparing all the sort of media they will put out on their website and via the press office, etc. So that'll be prepared. You know, the sort of little films you do, or so they'll probably press the button when they think. So either obviously if the medical shows up something untoward, that changes it. But everything is agreed, so it could well be today, if not tomorrow, I would guess. And then I don't know. You know, then say that with Wan-Bissaka signed and Daniel James, I'd say that's a pretty good start to the summer for Manchester United. But that's all it is. It's a good start.
Wan-Bissaka himself is obviously a defender. We've seen a lot of him this year, and he's been talked about a lot. Right back was an issue, we know, for Manchester United. Is that problem solved now? Do you think he immediately solved that problem?
It's a really interesting question, because I didn't actually think right back was that big an issue, because they've got Dalot there, who looks a good player. But what I think is going to happen, and so therefore you are kind of right, I think Dalot may well play left back if Shaw's not around, and Wan-Bissaka will play right back, compete with Dalot. I mean, Ashley Young's still there. He's going to be the captain. He is the captain now that Valencia's gone. But I can't... Well, you'd like to think Solskjaer isn't going to play him too much, because Solskjaer, you know, his teams that have shown, you know, the two teams he's managed, which is obviously Cardiff and the one in Norway, I can't remember the name of.
Mulder.
You know, he always wanted young, fast, mobile players. That's why I'm saying these two signs are a good start, you know, with regard to his management as well, because these are definitely his kind of players. It's one thing doing it for Palace, and fair play to the guy. I think he had the most challenges in all of Europe last season. But, you know, it's another thing coming to United and being able to turn it on. But, you know, this is what it's about. Are you good enough? But as I say, and the reason why I said this is because it is really pressing. They need to get three or four what I would call heavyweight established star players, United, to have any chance of, you know, being not challenging next season for the title, but, you know, top four kind of challenging.
They've now spent, what, 70-odd million quid on two players who between them have got two senior seasons of professional football. It feels like a risk. Do you think they are going to now look to try and sign, as you say, someone a bit more experienced, a first-teamer? And if so, who on earth could that be?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I mean, they're going to have to. I mean, if we're on the telephone discussing this, sort of 1st of September, it's only these two, then they've had a disaster, really, I would say. I mean, Lukaku's on his way by the look of it. I mean, you'd now say it's a surprise if he doesn't leave. It looks like Internazionale. So there's a striker. And also a weight of goals, because even though I think he only got 15 last year, I think, you know, Rashford may have got one or two more, but Rashford's not pulling up the kind of numbers as a centre-forward, a social centre-forward, you know, that he would want to, you know... Lukaku got 27 the season before. Now, Solskjaer and Rashford would say, well, wait till this is a Solskjaer side, you know, playing the way he wants. He's going to have all this summer to basically bed them all in. But yes, they're going to need a striker. I mean, you know, Dembele has spoken about the chap at Lyon. I've only ever seen him play twice, I think. Once for Celtic when they played City in the Champions League. He looked very good, but, you know, that's playing for Celtic. I don't know. You tell me how many players come in to Manchester United as a centre-forward from abroad or even on these shores and hit the ground running. It's difficult, isn't it? And that's what I'm saying. Can they pull two or three rabbits out of the hat to kind of, you know, make United... But what I would say is Solskjaer has got form for this. As you say, Molde was his team in Norway. He went in there and convinced them to win their very first title in their 100-year history. That was their 100th year, that year, 2011. Now, OK, it's Molde, everyone says. It's only, inverted commas, in Norway. But, you know, he has got some pedigree there. So you know, I think he will probably end this summer with four players, including the two we've already got, and, you know, the other two yet to come will be proper players, as I might describe them. And then I would say he's had a decent window. You know, a pretty good one, really. I mean, you tell me the last time they signed a sort of player like Wan-Bissaka or even James. Is it Wilfred Zaha under Ferguson?
I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's not necessarily a criticism, but you understand what I mean? I like what they've done here. I think if Ferguson stayed around as manager, Zaha might have been a player for them. I just don't think Moyes knew what to do with him, how to manage him.
Well, no, and I think he's probably a pretty unique player as well in terms of personality. And, you know, there's a lot of other things that went on with that. But then that's kind of Manchester United kind of make their own bed with that. Because actually, you say who was the last one to sign like that. I wonder about Luke Shaw. You know, back in 2014, he was only, 18 when they signed him. And we all know that the troubles that he went through. All right, he's come out the other side, it seems. But I just wonder, do you think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is going to go out of his way, and can he create an atmosphere and a club where it's easy to come in and play immediately? Because as you say, how many of these signings have looked like all right deals when they got done and it's just not worked out?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really obvious thing to say, James, but it really does come down to getting the right manager in any club. And the reason why I say that is because, you know, we're looking at this post-Ferguson era where they haven't won the title, they haven't really challenged. I know they came second under Mourinho, but I think they were 19 points down in City. I would say they've got the managers wrong. Yeah. I know it's easy to say in hindsight, I thought Moyes was a good idea, I thought Van Gaal, why not, for Mourinho? Because to give these people, you know, anyone the benefit of the doubt, because, you know, they must have something about them, especially Van Gaal and Mourinho. But I'm just wondering whether Solskjaer, what I'm saying is, I think Solskjaer, and again, you know, play this back to me if it all falls apart, I think they've got this one right, because he gets the club, you know, he is part. What I've been really, well, what I was really impressed with him was just how sort of at ease he seemed in the role. Now, I know they bombed badly towards the end of last season. I mean, they really should have got top four, if not finished third. But I still think that with this manager, with the players he's starting to get in, I think it's just the right way to go, because they are, you know, there's a freshness there. So to answer your question, yeah, I think he can create an atmosphere. Now, whether he's able to do it, as you sort of phrase the question, sort of straight away or fast, so that players can just drop in and they go flying. That's difficult, but, you know, let's wait and see. Someone's got to be the next very good Manchester United manager after Ferguson. Now, you know, it took Liverpool years to get this right, and maybe United will have the same challenge. But, you know, I'd like to think Solskjaer's got the best chance of anyone that they've had so far since Ferguson went.
Jamie, thank you so much for your time. As always, I'll let you get back to the sun, because it's a rare enough thing in Manchester and we shouldn't waste it. Jamie Jackson there, Manchester correspondent for The Guardian, from his garden in Manchester, the Garden Guardian correspondent. I did want to mention Aaron Wan-Bissaka there, and I'm glad that Jamie did, but also because Gregor Robertson's written a fine piece in the Times today. Gregor himself, a former footballer, by the way, now Football League correspondent for the Times. And just pointing out that Wan-Bissaka's big break actually came against Wilfred Zaha, funnily enough, because he was essentially the under-23 right-back, got injured. They needed someone to play against the first team, and Wan-Bissaka, at 18, got the call. And this was only 3 years ago, actually less than 3 years ago. He turned up, and he marked Wilfred Zaha out of the game. Now, remember that Wilfred Zaha, whatever you think of him, I imagine in a training session at Palace, he is quite regularly the best player on the pitch by a country mile. And he marked him out the game. 2 weeks later, he did the same thing to Andros Townsend in a training game. And they realised that this was a lad with some quality. And I don't doubt he's got some quality and a lot about him. But this was less than 3 years ago. He's played one season of senior football. United fans can't give him half a season, he plays badly, and go, right, that's it. If you believe in his talent, you have to give him time. He's going to need that sort of time. He's not necessarily going to pull up trees in the Europa League. I was going to say Champions League, but I didn't play in that anymore. He's not going to pull up trees in Europe straight away. Aaron Wan-Bissaka closing in on a United shirt for £50 million, but you need to give him time in it.
Love Sport.
Now it's time to talk Chelsea. We've got Daniel Kahn on the line, Chelsea writer for the Chelsea Echo and Vavil. Daniel, we thought we'd be talking about Frank Lampard today. I thought we might be talking about Chelsea manager Frank Lampard, but no news as yet. Do you think that we're going to be moving on this sooner rather than later?
Yeah, I mean, there have been reports that the deal should be finalised and it should be announced by the end of this week. So I've still got my hopes up that it will be finished. Hopefully Sunday is the latest. I don't want to go into a new week and it's not being confirmed.
Is it the right move for Chelsea, do you think?
It's a hard one, because there's two ways you can look at it. I think obviously very inexperienced, so I think that's one negative about the move. But I do think in the long term it will be the right move. I think the board are going to get him in and hopefully give him a lot of time. I'm just hoping now that we don't get him in, and if things go wrong early on, we change and panic. I hope that we give him a lot of time now. Obviously, with the transfer ban, there shouldn't be a lot of pressure on his shoulders. So I think the main thing about Frank Lampard and why the board have brought him in is because I think they're bringing him in to sort of reunite the fan base, because I think there's been a lot of toxicity recently in our fan base. I mean, you can see with all the Sarri stuff, there's been a lot of Sarri out people and a lot of fights between the fans. And
do you think the fans have been pretty harsh on Maurizio Sarri, given that he finished third and won the Europa League?
Yeah, 100%. Overall, I think a lot of the fans have been very harsh. I mean, I've been unsure about Sarri, but I think because he's reached his objectives, I think he deserved at least another season. But I think a lot of match going fans found his football very boring. And I can understand that, because I mean, watching a few of the games, it was a bit dull, and the attack hit, like we were having all this possession but weren't making enough chances. So I can understand why fans were frustrated. I do think, though, however, he should have been respected a lot more, especially what he did for us in his only season, unfortunately.
John Terry was speaking today to the Daily Mail. He says the perfect timing for Lampard to come to the club. He's a legend. Now's the right time for him to come home. Do you think it is the right time? In an ideal world, would you not rather he'd had two or three more years elsewhere to kind of actually get used to being a manager?
Yeah. Obviously, in an ideal world, you'd want him to have more experience. But these sort of opportunities don't come around very often, Lee. So I think Frank Lampard's taken out at the right time completely. Obviously, I've still got the doubts about inexperience, and I wish it was a few years down the line where he had a bit more experience, either with Derby or another club. But it's his opportunity now, he has to take it. And I think because we've got the transfer ban, I don't think the pressure will be on him immediately. I feel like he'll have a few years to build his team, and then after, I'd say, hopefully the third season, I think that's when he has to start being judged. But if the board, let me say that if the board sack him and panic, if it's not going well, I think a lot of the Chelsea fan base will really start turning against the board, because it's Frank Lampard. I mean, we can't be too harsh very quickly. You have to be very patient.
He obviously it looks like he's actually already got his first signing, despite the fact Chelsea are under a transfer ban. Mateo Kovacic's loan is going to get converted into a £40 million deal. I'll be honest, that looks like an absolutely shocking piece of business, is it?
I don't completely agree with that. I mean, I think the price is a bit... I'm not too happy with that. But at the end of the day, it's not my money, it's the club's money. We're a big club, so we have to pay these sort of fees now for players. But I think... He didn't have a good season under Sarri, but I think the reason was that he was played out of position. I felt like Sarri played him more as an attacking midfielder, but Mateo Kovacic, you can look at his attacking stats, you can see he's not a goal scorer, he doesn't create a lot of assists. And the best games he's been playing has been more of a deeper role. So I'm just hoping that Lampard uses him in the right way. And I think it is very important that we do sign him. I do disagree in terms of, I don't think it's a shocking move, because if you look at it, Loftus-Cheek's out until November or even October. I'm not too sure about the timescale. So if you look at our midfield options, we're a bit shallow. So he's needed to fill that void left by Loftus-Cheek just for depth reasons.
Mm.
But I can see why people are doubting the move, because obviously he hasn't had a good first season. But we have to remember this is his first season. That was his first season in English football. I think we should give him one more season before we really judge him.
We expect that Lampard's obviously going to use a lot of the youth players, or at least give them more of a chance we've seen in the past. He's got Jody Morris as his likely number two. Which do you think of the players who are maybe coming back from loan, which do you think is the most ready to make the step up and will get the opportunity to win a place in the first team?
That's a difficult question, because there's obviously a lot of names being touted around about which youth players can come into our team next season. But I think there's one standout one for me, and that's Reece James. He was at Wigan Athletic last season. He's an excellent right-back. I mean, I've watched quite a lot of Championship football last season. I live in Reading, so I go and watch quite a bit of Championship football, like I've just said. So I've seen how good he is. And if you look at our right-back situation, we've got Zappa Costa and Aspilicueta. I think Zappa Costa will be gone this summer, even with our transfer ban. I think we're going to be looking to sell him. And Aspilicueta, I mean, he's inconsistent nowadays. He can do a job on a few occasions, but there are games where he's just not good. So I feel like Reece James will get quite a lot of opportunities. But it's hard, though, because there are quite a few youth players who could break into the team next season. But if you're asking me to pick out one, I think it would be Reece James. I think there's something special there.
It's interesting as well, because I think Wigan signed him as a sort of backup right back. And within about 3 weeks, he was playing starting centre mid. He's clearly got a lot about him. Do you think right back is the place for him? I mean, you seem to have gone off Cesar Azpilicueta anyway.
I haven't fully gone off Cesar Azpilicueta. I just feel with Cesar Azpilicueta, he's lost his legs a bit. I mean, he's not got the pace he used to. And I think a lot of opposition now look at our team and be like, right, the fullback areas are where we need to target because there's not a lot of pace there. Mm. I think Azpilicueta is obviously in that category where he hasn't got a lot of pace. So it's obvious now that I think he's going to be the first choice next season. But I think Reece James will get a lot of chances next season. And then hopefully the season after is when we see Reece James starting to overtake Azpilicueta in terms of the pecking order.
And just finally, Tammy Abraham's obviously been thrown around a lot. We don't know what Gonzalo Higuain's future looks like. Do you think he is good enough to come and be potentially Chelsea's starting centre-forward?
That's a very difficult question. I mean, with Gonzalo Higuain, I don't think he's coming back. I think, obviously, with Sarri gone now to Juventus, I think that he will reunite with Sarri at Juventus. So I don't think he's got a future at the club anymore. And then if you look at that now, so if you look at, without Higuain, our options, we've got Giroud, Abraham, and potentially Batshuayi, but I'm not too sure what's going to happen with Michy. Hmm. So I don't know. If you look at it, I don't think Batshuayi's, he's had his chances, I think. I think he hasn't had loads of chances, but he's had his chance under Conte to prove himself. He didn't do it. So I'm not too sure if he's good enough. I think he might be sent back on loan or sold this summer. And then you've got left now with Giroud and Tammy Abraham. And for me, Giroud, he isn't a starter striker for me. He's more of a backup. He's more of a sort of sub striker, an impact player. So it sort of like inadvertently sort of brings it down to Tammy Abraham. I think with Tammy Abraham, you've got a goal scorer. Obviously, he's not proven in the Premier League, but what he did for Villa last season was outstanding. And he's had a bit of Premier League experience at Swansea, but obviously Chelsea's a massive step up. So, yeah, I do think he will be our starter next season, and I feel like he will fit Lampard's style of play more. But, yeah, I do think it's between Giroud and Tammy Abraham for the first team sort of striker, the first option. But I would go Tammy Abraham because I think he's a Lampard player. I think Lampard will develop him.
Well, from an England perspective, I hope you're right, Daniel. Thank you so much for coming on. Daniel Kahn there, Chelsea writer for the Chelsea Echo and Vavel, hoping that Tammy Abraham can be the man who can be developed by Frank Lampard. And as I say, as an England supporter, I'd love to see Frank Lampard give Tammy Abraham the chance in the first team. I'd love to see Tammy Abraham really excel at Premier League level. There is a chance.
This is Love Sport.
I just wanted to quickly touch on a text we had earlier from David Joyce, a Spurs fan out in Melbourne, Australia. Hello, David. Hope you're enjoying winter out in Australia. I hope you're not enjoying England losing to Australia, which is very depressing for us. He asked, will we let Dier, Wanyama and Lamela go now that we look to be signing two new fielders? Of course, Tanguy Ndombele is expected to be signed in the next few days. £60-odd million the fee for him. And we expect that they might pick up one more. I think Wanyama is gone. I think he's been poor. I've seen him play on a number of occasions for Spurs and he's not done well. I think Lamella's an underrated player, but he just hasn't been fit. And when it comes to Eric Dier, he's a guy who can cover a couple of different positions. He can play a centre-half. If you play in a back three, I'm getting a look from producer Kieran. Do you not think he can play in a back three?
No, I just think he's pretty poor. So right. I don't think he can play particularly well in any position, if I'm being brutally honest. And I think his name is rather apt.
Right. Okay, I'll take your word for it.
I'll leave it at that.
You're not here to complain about Eric Dier. You're here to complain about Chris Gayle reversing his retirement decision, aren't you?
It is an interesting one because about 6 months ago, I was not surprised that this World Cup would be his last involvement in international cricket. And then he had that terrific ODI series against England in the Caribbean. And you start to think, could he continue? But the way he's been acting in the field, he really much, very much is on his last legs. But he said that he's going to continue playing ODI cricket and even potentially make a return to Test cricket in the next few months. India goes to the Caribbean, and he suggested that he might be up for being involved in that. And from the West Indian point of view, that's a no-brainer, because Test match cricket is struggling in the Caribbean. It's dying there. Can you imagine if Chris Gayle decides, I'm going to play against India, people will rock up, even though attendances are pretty awful in Test cricket in the Caribbean, people will turn up just to watch Chris Gayle. So from the West Indian point of view, surely it's a no-brainer.
Doesn't it remind you of, you know, Avi de Villiers ringing up the South African selectors the night before the team gets announced saying, oh, no, I will play? Like, isn't it just a bit rich of Chris Gayle to go, no, I'm retiring, no, I'm playing again, and, oh, all right, I'll come back just because I feel like it? You know, because it's not as though Chris Gayle's been a loyal West Indian international. He has picked and chosen when to play for them. I think it's a bit rich for him now to go, oh, I'm not really retiring.
No, I think you make a good point. With the Avi de Villiers one, though, this is a World Cup, and sometimes international sport isn't fair. And we're not talking about AB de Villiers. AB de Villiers isn't just a good cricketer. We're talking about one of the elite players over the last decade. So for me, I know it's easy to say with hindsight, but South Africa should have just said yes and dropped someone else, and who cares, really? It's AB de Villiers. With Chris Gayle, I get what you mean, because he kind of led this movement from the West Indian players to go and play for money, really, elsewhere in the franchises around the world. And West Indian cricket has really suffered from guys like him, Dwayne Bravo, Kyron Pollard, not playing regularly for the West Indies. But I don't know, it's a tough one, because I can see both sides of it. But I just think because West Indian Test cricket is really dying and people just aren't going to watch it, the lure of Chris Gayle playing in the Test series against India later this year, I think would be an incredibly attractive one. And I think people would flock from all over the Caribbean to see Chris Gayle, because you don't know how many more Test matches he's going to play. We thought he wasn't going to play another one. So that financially would be so beneficial to the West Indian Cricket Board.
Do you think he could still do a job in Test cricket? Will he still be a useful member of the side?
I think he'd be putting his feet up when they're in the field. I don't think he'd be spending most of the 90 overs in a day of Test cricket out on the field. But it's a tough one, because he hasn't played Test cricket for a while now, and would he be able to settle in to Test cricket again? Who knows? India have got a very good bowling attack, so it wouldn't be easy for him. I don't think from a playing point of view it's necessarily the best thing, in terms of you're not going to get the best Chris Gayle, and I don't think he's going to absolutely storm it. But then he has scored a six off the first ball of a Test match, so I don't think he'll be being as negative as he is at the beginning of an innings in one day cricket. I think he'll be going out there to entertain, and I suppose that's what West Indian cricket fans love at the end of the day.
We've been watching the West Indians in the field this morning against India, and pretty impressive they've been as well. Where do you think West Indian cricket is as a whole? Because we talk about Chris Gayle, and obviously he's a massive figure, but they have got a lot of other personalities in this West Indian side. Do they desperately need Chris Gayle to reinvigorate the sport as a whole?
I think a big figure like that can help, because it inspires the kind of next generation that he is that figure of West Indian cricket over the last decade. I look at West Indian cricket, and it is dying out in the Caribbean, and when England travel out there, pretty much the whole stadium is full of England fans, not West Indian fans. So it is one of those areas where it's struggling. But actually, even though from an English perspective it was awful to lose quite convincingly out in the Caribbean earlier this year, that's a good thing for West Indies, and it's a good thing for Test cricket. We need the West Indies to be a good team, because it's just not competitive, and it would be horrendous to see a nation, we're seeing some highlights here, it would be horrendous to see a nation like the West Indies kind of not really playing Test cricket. It would be awful. They play little of it nowadays. So I think they've got young players to build off. They've got Craig Brathwaite at the top of the order, who's a good opening batsman, Shea Hope, who seems to only really turn up when it comes to playing against England, actually.
Well, basically, yeah.
Jason Holder, who I think is at times underrated as an all-rounder, batted superbly against England earlier this year. A good bowling attack. I know Kemal Roach is coming towards the end of his career, but him, O'Shane Thomas is a young bowler. Alzari Joseph is a player I really, really rate. He's a young guy. Shannon Gabriel, who obviously was in the news for some of the wrong reasons, but also bowled superbly. So they've got the foundations there, I think, of a good team. I think they need to be playing more regularly, because some of the teams just don't play Test cricket that often, and you're never going to improve dramatically if you're only playing, kind of 6 or 7 test matches a calendar year, whereas England obviously have about 3 to 4 series, well, about 4 series over the whole calendar year. So I think they've got the foundations there. And guys like Chris Gayle, I think, still do have a role to play in making sure that West Indies test cricket doesn't kind of completely go down the drain.
In terms of their performance against India today, do you think they'll chase it down?
I think if it was a bilateral series, I think I would probably put West Indies slightly ahead of India. But as we've seen in this tournament, batting first, which has not been the trend over the last 4 years, batting first has actually been the way to go. And it means if you can put a good total in India, they've not put a massive total on, but they've given themselves a good chance. And I just think, for example, there was a game that West Indies played against New Zealand at the same ground that they looked like they were going to chase the score of 290, but then they capitulated from about 120 for 2. And they just fell away. I know they nearly dramatically won that game, but they fell away really in the middle overs. So I still would have to fancy India. But this West Indian team, I don't think will be kind of thinking, oh, we're down in the dumps, we're not going to be able to chase this, with performances from Carlos Brathwaite in that run chase. If a few more guys can contribute, they're fully capable of chasing this total down.
And do you think it's... I mean, this game doesn't really affect what happens to England in their qualification for the semi-finals. Is there a result we're hoping for nevertheless?
It's a tough one again, because do you want to face a wounded animal in India if they lose today? But if West Indies win today, I don't think they've really got any chance of winning, because even if they won their final few games, it's still incredibly unlikely that they'd get through just by the matter of other teams playing each other. So I think from an England perspective, we would rather the West Indies win, because if they do, England would be 1 point behind India. And then obviously England play India on Sunday. So actually...
Could create a bit of a buffer.
We're worried about kind of the teams below us, but actually if we can get ahead of one of the other top three, then that reduces that problem. So I think the West Indies will be cheering them on over the next few hours.
Excellent. We'll be cheering the West Indies on, and we'll keep you right up to date with that. The chase should start in just a few minutes at Old Trafford. They are chasing, by the way, 269 to win off their 50 overs.
This is Love Sport.
Now, England, of course, take on Norway tonight. It's a massive game for both sides, frankly. Norway, of course, are without their best player, Ada Hegerberg, boycotting the World Cup. She's the Ballon d'Or winner, and yet she is not taking part in the World Cup because a sort of protest about the treatment of women's football. It's all very well and it's very worthy, but it's also great news for England because it means they don't take her on. That doesn't mean Norway don't carry a threat, though. They've got a number of different options. Giro Reitan, I think, is probably the most worrying one. She plays for Chelsea, of course. She's probably going to play on the left-hand side for Norway. We might see Nikita Paris deployed as a sort of extra help for Lucy Bronze, who I know has been struggling with illness. Johnny Burrow, football fan show host, and also on Friday nights from 7 o'clock, the Women's World Cup show host. You will, of course, be watching with a keen eye while trying to broadcast tonight, Johnny. How confident are you in England tonight?
I'm much more confident than I would be if Ada Hegerberg were in action. I think England have got a good chance. The focus for Neville has to be on organisation, because actually, whisper it, the Lionesses haven't looked particularly exciting going forward yet. The focus has to be on that spine, on that solidity, and then a nice 1-2-0 win would do us very, very nicely.
How important is it to have Steph Houghton and Millie Bright fit?
Houghton is massive, not just in terms of what she brings.
I mean, she's a physically imposing character, is that what you mean?
No, she's a very athletic young lady, but for the hopes of the team, she's an enormous character. She's very important in terms of not just how robust and organised that defence is, but also scoring goals and just bringing that spirit to the entire team. She is the leader in there, and she needs to be in that side.
Millie Bright, I read an interesting thing from Ian Herbert this morning suggesting that actually Millie Bright being out might be a blessing in disguise, because Abby McManus, who would come in, actually is a better distributor of the ball and might give England a bit more help in possession anyway.
Well, I'm feeling a bit cynical about Phil Neville in the sense that I'm still not convinced he knows what his best team is, which is sacrilege to say. But actually, it might be no bad thing if some of these trickier decisions are made for him. He can focus on the specific approach of the team rather than agonising about who the team is.
I'm not going to probe you on the various threats of the likes of Isabel Herlofsson and Caroline Hansen, Johnny, although I'm sure that you probably could. Oh, yeah, OK, that face is yes, you definitely could give me some expert opinions on them, but I won't. Instead, in terms of goal scoring threat, Ellen White hasn't looked like an out and out goal scorer in this tournament, but she seems to have linked England up rather well.
Ellen White is the kind of striker I absolutely adore and all England fans should get behind because she doesn't make it look pretty, she doesn't make it look natural, but she knows how to score goals. Look at that little lifted finish just recently, the first of her two goals. She's just a goal scorer, I think, and she is central to that team because, again, she brings that presence. I was surprised going into this. I thought we might see more of Tony Duggan than we have. The reason for that, one of the many, is because White has been so, so dynamic, really.
I have seen a lot of Tony Duggan. Well, at least I've seen games that she's been playing in, and I've not seen an awful lot of her so far. Is she fully fit?
Not quite, but I think also just underwhelming. And Ellen White's finishing recently has been very, very impressive. And my favourite thing about her is that every time she scores a goal, she looks surprised. Despite the fact that she is a top-level striker in the running for the Golden Boot at a World Cup, the ball hits the back of the net, and before she does her stupid glasses goal celebration, which I'm not going to engage with, she just, turns to her teammates.
You just did the Ellen White, Johnny.
Oh, I did. Well, as a glasses wearer, I'm allowed. But she will turn to her nearest Lionesses teammate with a face that simply says, "How did that happen? I did it again."
Brilliant. Well, it's going to be a great game. It starts at 8 o'clock. And, of course, the best way to watch it is with Johnny Burrow in the background. Now, I'm delighted to say that my next guest is a England legend. Faye White, 90 caps for England, captain, 300 appearances for Arsenal ladies to boot as well. Faye, thank you so much for coming on the show on what is quite a nervous day for England fans all over. Are you starting to feel the nerves?
Yeah, definitely. Always do when the team are playing. Obviously, willing them on to succeed and kicking and heading every ball most games with them. So yeah, it's going to be a tough one against Norway tonight.
Obviously, Phil Neville sweating on the fitness of Millie Bright and Steph Houghton. How important is it to have those two fit? Steph, especially, I'd imagine.
Yeah, of course. She's our leader and our captain. Always leads by example, really controls that back line and the team. So she's a vital one. I think she will be fit enough to start. I think she trained yesterday. So knowing Steph, she will, you know, nothing will stop her if she can get on that field. Millie, I'm not sure about, because you never know how a virus can affect someone and their strength afterwards and being able to recover in just a day or two. So it'll be interesting to see if he has to make that change. But equally, Abby McManus come on for her in the second game, I think it was, when she had to go off Millie Bright. So she's already had some experience if he does use her. Or there's even Leah Williamson, who has, you know, quite a lot of experience at youth age, is captaining, you know, the youth England teams too.
You mentioned the experience, you know, and you can't fault Leah Williamson. Of course, her domestic experience is outstanding as well. How good do you rate this squad in terms of depth compared to some of the squads that you played in?
Oh, yeah, a massive contrast, really. You know, we were having a lot of players come into their World Cups and Euros for the first time when we were playing and experiencing them as a group together. Whereas nowadays, the likes of like Georgia Stanway, Leah Williamson, Nikita Paris come into the squad having played through all the age groups and having played in Euros and World Cups and getting used to what a tournament, you know, what tournament football feels like and the different emotions and highs and lows that you have to go through. And, you know, so when they now come step into a senior World Cup, it's not so much of a, you know, experience and kind of jump up for them, I suppose. Yes, senior level is a bit higher, but most of these girls are playing against top international players week in, week out in the WSL now, because the WSL and clubs like Chelsea, Arsenal, Man City are attracting the top players.
In terms of the starting lineup and the very best players in the England side, you know, I have to admit, I haven't watched a huge amount of women's football before this World Cup, but that for me, Nikita Paris has done some things that I've been absolutely blown away by. How good is she and how important is she when England are going forward?
Yeah, she will be key. That kind of relationship she's building up with Lucy Bronze, and her fact that having Lucy Bronze, a player like her as well behind her, with the forward-making runs that she can make and a game intelligence as well, really helps Nikita. But Nikita's learning and still growing. She's still only young, relatively. I know she's about 25 now, but quite a new player in the squad, but she's certainly taking the kind of weight of the expectation on her shoulders and using that to the best to get the more out of her. And you know, she's having a fine career when she was at Man City, and she's just recently moved to Lyon as well, so that will be another big challenge for her. But yeah, she's done some great things, stepped up for that penalty against Scotland first of all, so yeah, she's certainly taken the stage by storm.
Ellen White just keeps finding ways to score goals, to the surprise mostly of herself, as far as I can tell. she's not an orthodox striker, but she just gets it done, doesn't she?
Yeah, she is. I always used to say to Ellen, stay on your feet. She just shoots and falls on her bum. But it's her way. It's her style. And, you know, if it means the ball goes in the back of the net, then not a problem. Because she, you know, she used to come off the field exhausted. And I'd be like, well, that's because you're down and up, you know, on your bum a lot after you shoot. So it's a joke with her. But, no, she's been amazing, really. And with the clinical finishing that she kind of does. But the work rate she does for the team. But she's learnt over the years not to, knowing when to do that chasing and closing down as a forward, because that's part of the game too. But then, you know, being able to, when she's called upon in those vital moments, when the ball is played through to her, maybe when we haven't seen the ball for very much of the game, certainly in some of the second half, certainly against Japan and what have you, to then be able to go and score and finish that chance she gets.
Faye, thank you so much for joining us. I'm really looking forward to tonight, but thank you for getting in touch with us. That's Faye White there, an absolute England legend, England Norway tonight.
This is Love Sport.
Of course, the biggest story that's been running on and off throughout the last couple of weeks is Tanguy Ndombele to Tottenham. It's something that Spurs fans are getting very excited about because they're actually going to spend some money on a player. Let's speak to one now. Martin Bahagia is a board member of the Spurs Supporters Trust, and you won't find many bigger Tottenham fans. Martin, very exciting. You might actually sign a player.
I know, possibly two. You never know. You want 18 months to sign a player, and then two come along at once. You know, it's exciting times.
Tanguy and Jack Clarke obviously come through at Leeds. Yeah. He's had one season. It's very much a signing for the future, but Tanguy and Ndombele looks more like a guy who can have an instant impact in the first team, do you think?
Yeah, I think everyone could see once we let Moussa Dembele go, and we understood the reasons why we had to let him go. But once we let him go, he was a vital cog in our midfield, and from what we've seen, you know, it's always dangerous to look at players on YouTube, but you always do, don't you? From what we can see of Ndombele, he looks like a ready-made replacement, probably more athletic, fitter, stronger, because Dembele obviously had his injury problems. So it's a big shoes to fill, but he looks like the man that could be about to try and fill them, which is very good news.
Do you think this £60 million outlay, do you think you're going to see much more? I mean, the figures seem to get bigger and bigger in the run-up to the transfer window about how much exactly Tottenham were going to spend. But do you think if they spend £60 million on Ndombele, that'll be it for the big signings?
I don't think so. I think there's a push. I think there are players that are going to leave. And it makes sense to let certain players leave, I think, at this stage. And so I think there will be replacements coming in. I think Maurizio Pochettino was clear at the end of the season, wasn't he, that he wanted to be backed in the transfer window, and he feels we could achieve wonderful things as a club if he gets that support. I think the board have always looked to spot. I don't know what had gone on. It looked like a decision that they all made in the last few years to keep it as stable as possible on the field, and that's worked. It's worked well. We're in the Champions League again, and now we're hopefully going in a different direction. But I think there'll be more signings. I think there's areas of the team that need addressing that Maurizio's spoken about in the last sort of, you know, 3 or 4 weeks of the season that he wanted to strengthen in. So yeah, I hope players will come in. I think players will go as well, and that will probably help finance those deals. But yeah, exciting times for us. You know, I think just the fact that we're signing somebody who, you know, who's been linked with PSG, Barcelona, and whoever else, if we do get him over the line, it's a fantastic signing and a real statement of intent.
A new stadium, a Champions League final, a £60 million signing. Are you out of the we're not really here stage yet? Are you still sort of pinching yourself as a Spurs fan?
Yeah, it's been such a weird season, because obviously there was the disappointment on the field of sort of being in the title race, if you like, at January, just being a couple of points off Liverpool and City, and then it all tailing off. And really the reasons for that were because we had injuries, and our squad, I've always said, I think our first 11's up there with the best, and our squad's probably not quite as strong, so that made sense. But yeah, we've sort of had people, particularly Arsenal fans, telling us, oh, when we moved to the Emirates, we didn't sign anyone, and people almost accepting that will happen because that's what they did. But we've been working under a different model, so it's great that we're showing that it can be done, that you know, the board, Daniel Levy and the board have worked wonders. They've got the stadium sorted, that period's over, people are looking forward, and now we're looking to sign players, and we know there's money there because obviously we're bidding £65 million for a player. So yeah, the last 6 months have just been incredible, like, as you say, Champions League final, getting to the new stadium, getting back there, there's a real feeling of momentum. And although there was a huge disappointment at losing the Champions League final, it's one of those that we've qualified again next season that we can look to build on that.
And with the signing of Jack Clarke, we sort of moved past it, but are you pleased to see that Tottenham aren't abandoning, you know, some of their stated aims earlier on in this process, that they are still looking to pick up some of the best young talent around the UK?
Yeah, I think there's an interesting story that I'd heard. I mean, I don't know how true it is, but apparently Leeds wanted Jack Clarke back for a year on loan, and Poch said he didn't want to, if we're doing it, he wants to keep him because he sees him as someone who could be in and around the first team squad this season. So he obviously sees something in him. And I think it's great because there's nothing more exciting than seeing somebody, you know, an 18-year-old lad coming through the ranks or being signed and getting his chance in the first team. Remember when obviously Dele Alli did that, and it was such an exciting time. And again, from what I've seen of Jack Clarke at Leeds, he's very direct, beats that first man, whips the ball into the front post. And that's something that we've not really had, because Kane, I think Harry Kane's probably suffered a bit in terms of the delivery that we've been giving him in the last 6 months of the season. Our crosses have been overhit. They've been going high and wide. So it'd be really good to have an out-and-out winger who's looking to get outside his man and whip that ball in. I think someone like Harry Kane will be looking at that signing thinking, yeah, I can play off him. I can play off his crosses. So, yeah, it's great. And who knows? You know, sometimes these things happen. You sign someone who thinks for the future and then they go straight in and they hit the ground running, and then before you know it, they're a regular. So, yeah, exciting times.
Martin, thank you so much for coming on. Great to speak to you in positive circumstances. It's not always been the case, but Tottenham about to finally spend some money on some players. Martin Bahagia, board member of the Spurs Supporters Trust. They are, of course, closing in on a £60 million deal for Tanguy Ndombele and an £11 million deal for Leeds wonderkid Jack Clarke.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.